Picture this for a second. You are driving down the highway on this crisp, beautiful fall morning. You've got your coffee right there in the cup holder. Maybe the radio is playing softly, and you are just, cruising along.
Sounds pretty ideal, honestly.
Right. But then you take a slight curve in the road. Maybe you're heading up a small hill, and suddenly, without absolutely any warning at all, you are completely and totally blinded by the sun.
Oh, that is the worst feeling.
I mean, it is just a solid wall of pure white light hitting your windshield. Your pupils don't even have time to constrict. You can't see the lane markers. You can't see the brake lights of the car in front of you.
You can't even see the hood of your own car sometimes.
Exactly. It feels terrifying. And honestly, more importantly, it feels completely out of your control. It feels like a total act of nature. But the question we are asking today on this deep dive is, well, if you hit someone in that terrifying, blinding moment, does the law actually see it as an act of nature?
That is the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, that
Because
is.
it is the absolute definition of a nightmare scenario for anyone behind the wheel. And it happens to thousands of drivers every single year.
Right.
We naturally want to categorize it as this unavoidable freak occurrence. We like to think that because we physically cannot control the sun or, like, the rotation of the earth, we shouldn't be blamed for what happens when that star just happens to blind us.
Right, because it feels entirely binary. Like I couldn't see, therefore I couldn't avoid the crash.
Exactly.
So, welcome to our deep dive. Today, we are looking at an incredibly insightful legal brief from the law offices of Norman Gershon. And they focus heavily on sun glare car accidents, specifically in Westchester County in New York City.
It's a very localized, very serious issue.
It really is. And our mission today is to unpack exactly who is liable when someone stands in front of a judge or, an insurance adjuster and uses the excuse, well, the sun was in my eyes. And I have to tell you, the foundational premise of this source material completely caught me off guard.
Oh, I bet. It serves as a very harsh reality check for a lot of commuters who think they understand the rules of the road.
It really does. Because under New York law, experiencing sudden blinding sun glare is absolutely, unequivocally not a valid excuse for causing a crash.
Yeah, that's the big shocker for most people. What's fascinating here is how the legal system distinguishes between an unavoidable act of nature and human agency.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Well, we tend to view weather or natural phenomena like a sudden blinding glare from a low-hanging sun as an act of God. We put it in the exact same category as a lightning strike.
Sure.
But the law looks at it through a completely different lens. The law focuses entirely on anticipation and reaction.
Okay, let's unpack this because I need to push back just a little bit here. I want to look at this from the perspective of just the average driver. If I'm driving at night and I hit a patch of black ice, I couldn't see it coming.
Right, it's invisible.
Totally invisible until I am already sliding out of control. And sudden sun glare feels exactly the same to the driver experiencing it. You turn a corner and bam, your vision is gone. How can I be considered negligent just because the sun happened to be shining at that exact geometric angle at that exact second?
That is the precise argument so many drivers make right after a collision. But if we connect this to the bigger picture of our legal system, we have to look at the foundational concept of reasonable care.
Reasonable care.
Right. The law doesn't punish the weather, it doesn't punish the sun for shining, and it doesn't punish the winter for creating ice. What the law punishes is a driver's failure to adapt to their environment.
Oh, interesting. So it's about the adaptation.
Exactly. Every single person behind the wheel has a legal duty to operate their vehicle safely based on the current conditions, not the ideal conditions. When visibility drops, whether that's due to, a sudden blizzard, a heavy bank of fog rolling in, or intense sun glare, your legal duty of care doesn't just pause, it actually increases.
Meaning, I can't just throw my hands up, cover my eyes, and say, well, nature blinded me. Good luck, everybody else on the highway.
You certainly cannot. The brief from the law offices of Norman Gershon explicitly details the behavioral precautions drivers are legally expected to take the exact moment conditions change.
Like what? What are we supposed to do in a split second?
Well, the split second your visibility is compromised by glare, you are required to immediately reduce your speed.
Okay, that makes sense.
You also need to actively increase your following distance from the car in front of you. You have to give yourself a wider reaction margin. And you are expected to utilize the equipment built into your car, like your sun visors. Plus, you should really be wearing sunglasses if you are driving during hours when glare is a known risk.
So if you don't do those things.
Right? If you ignore these basic mechanical adaptations and you just keep your foot resting on the gas pedal at 65 miles per hour, and you rear end someone because you couldn't see them stopping.
Then you're at fault.
You aren't a victim of the sun at that point. You are legally negligent.
Wow. Okay, but here's where the source material gets incredibly granular, and I have to say it blew my mind, because they list something else under preventable issues that increase the risk of a crash.
Right.
And it's not just about speed or sunglasses.
Let me guess. The windshields.
Yes. It's about dirty windshields.
Oh, the physical condition of your auto glass is a massive, often completely overlooked liability.
I always just thought of a dirty windshield as, like, a minor annoyance. You know, maybe you get a little bit of road salt spraying up from the car ahead of you, or some pollen in the spring. You squint a little until you finally get to the gas station. But the brief points out that failing to use your wiper fluid and keeping your windshield crystal clean can literally be the deciding factor in a legal negligence claim.
It really can. And the physical science behind why that matters is crucial for understanding the law here.
Tell me about the science.
Well, when you have a perfectly clean, pristine windshield, sunlight passes directly through the glass. It might be bright, sure, but the light rays remain relatively organized. But when you have a layer of grime, dried road salt, or even just microscopic dust particles coating that glass, it changes the physics of the light entering your vehicle. That layer of dirt acts as thousands of tiny little prisms.
Oh, wow.
So when the harsh sunlight hits a dirty windshield, instead of passing straight through to your eyes, the light scatters. It diffuses wildly across the entire surface of the glass. You're effectively turning your transparent window into a glowing, completely opaque sheet of white light.
That is wild. So by not spending 2 seconds pulling the little lever behind the steering wheel to spray some wiper fluid, you are actively manufacturing a much worse visual hazard for yourself. You're basically turning your own windshield into a flashbang.
That is a very visceral way to put it, but it's totally accurate. You failed to maintain your vehicle in a way that allows for safe operation. And in the eyes of the law, that seemingly minor failure to adapt your equipment can be the linchpin that proves you were negligent.
So if a dirty windshield acts as a prism, I mean, imagine a million of those dirty windshields all driving together.
Terrifying.
Right. So since we now know the mechanics of how drivers fail to adapt, I want to talk about the geography of this problem. The brief focuses heavily on the region encompassing Westchester County, White Plains, Yonkers, the Bronx, and Manhattan. Why is this specific area such a hotspot for these types of crashes?
It's honestly a perfect storm of environmental and infrastructural factors.
Mm-hmm.
You are dealing with a massive volume of daily commuters, very specific hilly topography, and legacy roadways that were designed decades ago and are notorious for exactly this type of hazard.
Right. The source actually names the specific roadways. It highlights the Hutchinson River Parkway, the Bronx River Parkway, I-287, and the Cross Bronx Expressway.
Yeah, notorious.
Anyone who drives these routes regularly knows exactly what this feels like. You've got these winding, narrow parkways with sudden elevation changes, sharp curves, heavy tree canopies that create this crazy strobe light shadow effect, and incredibly dense high-speed traffic.
It's incredibly disorienting.
1 second, you are driving in the deep shade of a tree line, and the next second, the road curves east, and you are just staring down the barrel of a laser beam.
And the timing of the commute is what transforms those specific winding roadways from merely difficult into genuinely treacherous. Sunrise and sunset are obviously the prime hazard windows, but the brief notes, it becomes particularly dangerous during the fall and winter commutes.
Why fall and winter specifically?
Because of the tilt of the earth during those colder seasons, the sun doesn't just pass high overhead quickly. It sits very low on the horizon for extended periods.
Right.
So during both the morning rush hour heading into the city and the evening commute heading out, that low-hanging sun is firing directly into the line of sight of millions of windshields simultaneously.
But wait, let me stop you right there. Because if everyone driving eastbound on I-287 at 7:30 in the morning is dealing with the exact same low-hanging sun, and everyone's windshield is getting hit by the exact same light, how do you prove one specific person is at fault?
That's a great question.
I mean, if the person who rear-ended me was blinded, but I was completely blinded too, we're all just driving blindly into the light. How does the law separate the hazard from the liability?
This cuts right to the heart of accident litigation. It goes back to separating the universal hazard from the individual behavior.
Okay, walk me through that.
Let's do a scenario. A massive sun glare event happens on the Cross Bronx Expressway. Visibility instantly drops to near zero for, say, a quarter-mile stretch of highway. Car A's driver immediately takes their foot off the gas, taps their brakes lightly to signal the person behind them that there's a problem, flips down their visor, and increases their following distance.
The perfect driver.
Right. Now, car B, dealing with the exact same sun, simply squints, maintains their speed of 65 miles per hour, and just relies on the hope that traffic ahead won't stop. Car B inevitably rear-ends car A.
Ouch.
The sun was identical for both drivers. The environmental hazard was universal. But the fault lies entirely in the fact that car B's driver chose not to uncap their speed or following distance for those specific conditions.
That makes the distinction incredibly clear. So the sun provides the context, but the driver's specific reaction provides the liability.
Precisely. And that individual behavior is exactly what gets heavily scrutinized in the aftermath of a crash.
Okay, so let's say the absolute worst happens. A crash occurs on the Hutchinson River Parkway, and the sun was a major factor for both drivers. Maybe neither of them reacted perfectly.
It happens all the time.
Like maybe I tapped my brakes, but I didn't have my visor down, and the other person was speeding. How does the law untangle who pays for the damaged cars and the medical bills? Because if both people made a mistake, it sounds like an administrative nightmare. Wait, if I'm partially to blame, shouldn't my insurance just cover my mistakes and their insurance cover theirs? Why is this even a negotiation?
Because personal injury and property damage in a multi-vehicle crash rarely divide cleanly down the middle. New York handles this messy reality through a legal doctrine called comparative negligence.
Comparative negligence, okay.
And the most vital takeaway for anyone listening to this deep dive who might be dealing with the Gershon brief is this. Under New York's comparative negligence rule, an injured victim can still recover financial compensation even if a jury determines they were partially at fault for the accident.
Okay, let me try an analogy here to make sure I really grasp the mechanics of this. Liability in New York isn't an all-or-nothing system. It's not a light switch where you are either 100% guilty or 100% innocent.
Right, it's a spectrum.
It's more like a massive bar tab after a night out with friends. Let's say we all go out and we rack up a massive bill. The bartender doesn't care who drank the expensive scotch and who drank the tap water. The total tab just has to be paid.
That is a very apt comparison.
In a crash, the jury looks at the total physical and financial damage, the overall tab, and then they go line by line through our behavior. They might say, okay, the other driver was speeding and tailgating. They have to pay 80% of the tab, but you forgot to put your visor down and reacted a second too late, so you have to pay 20% of the tab. Does comparative negligence mean I can still force their insurance to pay their 80% of my massive medical bills, even though I contributed to that 20%?
Yes, that is a much more accurate and practical way to look at it. You do not lose your right to hold a reckless driver accountable just because you made a minor error. If a jury determines your total medical and property damages are, say, $100,000, but they look at the bar tab of fault and find you 20% responsible because, say, your windshield was dirty, your final award is simply reduced by your percentage of blame.
Okay, I see.
You would still walk away with $80,000 to help rebuild your life.
Well, when you break it down like that, the system sounds designed to be highly equitable.
It is equitable in legal theory. But what's crucial to understand, and frankly, deeply frustrating for victims, is how this comparative negligence system is aggressively manipulated in the real world.
Oh, I bet I know who manipulates it.
Yep. This brings us to the entity that almost always sits across the table in these situations. The insurance companies. Insurance companies weaponize the comparative negligence rule from the very first phone call.
Because if they can artificially inflate my slice of the blame, like if they can convince a jury I drank more of the drinks on that bar tab, they have to pay me significantly less money.
That is their entire business model. They are massive corporations built on risk mitigation and minimizing financial payouts. They will look at a clear-cut case where their insured driver was recklessly speeding and rear-ended you, and they will immediately try to use the sun glare as a weapon against you, the victim.
Unbelievable.
They send investigators to look at your car. They will argue, well, the victim's wiper fluid reservoir was empty, or the victim wasn't wearing polarized sunglasses, therefore the victim is actually 50% or 60% responsible.
They really do that.
Oh, constantly. They will record your post-crash statements where you say, I couldn't see anything, and try to twist that into an admission that you were driving while blind. They actively manufacture narratives to shift the majority of the blame onto the victim just to protect their corporate profit margins.
Wow. So you are not just recovering from whiplash or a broken collarbone. You are actively fighting a multi-billion dollar corporation that is trying to gaslight you and the jury into thinking your catastrophic injuries are actually your own fault.
Which is exactly why attempting to navigate a sun glare accident claim on your own is incredibly dangerous financially. The moment the crash happens, you are stepping into an arena with highly trained corporate professionals whose only job is to devalue your experience and find a reason to deny your claim.
And this brings us directly to the core of our source material and why the law offices of Norman Gershon published this brief in the first place. When you are up against an insurance company that is actively trying to shift the blame and weaponize the weather against you, you cannot rely on polite negotiation.
No, you absolutely can't.
You need a legal heavyweight in your corner. You need someone whose reputation precedes them into the settlement room.
You need leverage. Insurance companies only respond to the credible threat of losing in court. And the source material paints a very clear picture of what that leverage looks like. Norman Gershon brings over 35 years of hardcore trial experience to the table.
Yeah, there is a line in the brief describing him that I actually circled and highlighted multiple times because it speaks volumes. He is known as the attorney other lawyers call to try their toughest cases. I want to linger on that because most people think a lawyer is just a lawyer.
Right, but that distinction is everything in the legal ecosystem. The vast majority of personal injury attorneys are litigators who strongly prefer to settle cases out of court.
Because it's easier.
Exactly. Trials are incredibly expensive, highly unpredictable, and require a really specialized skill set regarding jury psychology and evidence presentation. When a general practice attorney or a smaller firm hits a wall, say the insurance company flat out refuses to offer a fair settlement, or the opposing defense team is a massive, well-funded corporate entity, those smaller lawyers don't just give up.
They call in a specialist.
Yes. They call a seasoned trial lawyer who actually relishes the opportunity to step into a courtroom and dismantle an insurance company's defense.
They bring in a closer, someone who isn't afraid of the courtroom. And if you're in the NYC or Westchester area, you can actually reach them directly at 914-485-4444. You know, insurance companies really know and fear Norman Gershon, and you only pay if you win.
That's a huge point. The threat of an attorney who is willing and eager to take a case to a jury verdict is often what forces the insurance companies to finally offer the compensation the victim actually deserves.
And the brief doesn't just make empty, aggressive claims. It brings the receipts. I want to read some of these case results because they illustrate exactly how high the stakes get. We are talking about tens of millions of dollars recovered overall.
The numbers are staggering.
Listen to these specific numbers. A $16.5 million verdict for an auto accident involving a bus. A $14.5 million settlement for a catastrophic injury case. A $7.5 million verdict for a transit accident. And a $2.5 million verdict specifically for a Westchester motor vehicle case. I mean, beating a commercial bus company's elite legal defense team for $16.5 million is not something you achieve by just showing up and saying the sun was bright.
No, winning verdicts of that magnitude requires an immense level of forensic preparation. It requires hiring accident reconstruction experts, subpoenaing vehicle maintenance records to prove a commercial driver's sun visor was broken, analyzing digital black box data, and possessing this innate understanding of how to present a highly complex technical narrative to an everyday jury.
It's basically a science.
It is. But what I find equally compelling in the source material is how it grounds those massive, intimidating numbers with real human experiences.
You're talking about the client testimonials.
Yes. Because when you hear about multi-million dollar verdicts and aggressive trial tactics, it's very easy to picture a cold, hyper-corporate law firm where injured clients are just treated as case numbers on a spreadsheet.
Right.
But the testimonials tell a remarkably different story about the day-to-day culture at this firm. You have quotes like, "He got me a bigger settlement than I expected," and "professional, confident, and incredibly prepared." But the one that really anchors the brief is simply, "He made me feel like I was his only client."
That quote stopped me in my tracks too. Because if you have just been involved in a devastating multi-car pileup on the Cross Bronx Expressway, your car is totaled, you are facing months of physical therapy, and your entire life is turned upside down, you don't just need a legal tactician.
You need an advocate.
Exactly. You need an advocate. You need to know that someone is actively carrying that immense stress for you so you can actually focus on healing.
And that level of personal attention is crucial, especially in the chaotic, confusing days immediately following a crash. Which organically brings us to the highly practical advice provided at the end of the brief. Because before a trial lawyer like Norman Gershon can step into a courtroom and fight for you, what you do in the immediate seconds and minutes after a sun glare crash dictates the fundamental strength of your entire case.
Because the insurance company starts building their defense against you the second the cars stop moving.
Exactly. Your defense has to start immediately. So the source outlines a very specific post-crash playbook. First, you must call 911 and formally report the crash. You absolutely need an objective, official police record of the event.
Makes sense.
Second, take photos of the scene. But not just the damage to the vehicles, take wide photos of the environmental and lighting conditions.
Okay, wait, I love that second point.
Third, seek medical attention immediately, even if you feel okay in the moment, because adrenaline masks serious injuries. And fourth, speak with a car accident lawyer. Again, that number for Gershon is 914-485-4444 before you give any recorded statements to the insurance companies.
I have to highlight that step number two again. Taking photos of the lighting conditions, I had a total moment of realization reading that, because if we get into a fender bender, our immediate instinct is to jump out and photograph the dented bumper, the license plates, maybe the shattered glass on the asphalt.
Right, the obvious stuff.
But remembering to take a step back and take a picture of the blinding sunlight, the length of the shadows on the road, the exact angle of the glare coming through the trees right then and there,
yeah,
that is a brilliant strategic move.
It's often the most essential evidence in a glare-related claim. Think about the timeline of accident response. By the time the police navigate through the resulting traffic jam, arrive on the scene, secure the area, check on the drivers, and finally begin writing their report, 45 minutes or an hour might have easily passed.
And the Earth has kept rotating. The sun has literally moved across the sky.
Exactly. The physical evidence of the primary hazard has vanished into thin air. The lighting condition that caused the crash no longer exists. If you don't capture it in the moment with your smartphone, it devolves into a game of he said, she said, with a skeptical insurance adjuster.
Which you'll lose.
Probably. Capturing the lighting perfectly preserves the exact environmental context you are dealing with, which gives your attorney the concrete, irrefutable proof they need to bring in those accident reconstruction experts and build your case.
Man, that is such good advice. So what does this all mean for you listening right now, whether you are commuting down the Bronx River Parkway or just running errands in your neighborhood? Let's wrap this up. Sudden sun glare happens in an absolute fraction of a second, but the physical, emotional, and financial impacts of the resulting crash can last for years, and sometimes for the rest of a person's life. The core takeaway from the law offices of Norman Gershon is that the sun is not a legal excuse. It is simply a driving condition, and you have a strict legal duty to adapt your driving to meet it. But, crucially, if you are struck by someone else who failed to adapt, someone who kept speeding blindly into the light, or who didn't bother to clean their windshield, you have rights. You do not have to accept the blame just because the sun was bright.
Right. Don't let them intimidate you.
And the law offices of Norman Gershon are committed to helping victims across NYC and Westchester protect those rights, fight back against the manipulative tactics of insurance companies, and secure the compensation they actually deserve to put their lives back together. Remember, that number is 914-485-4444.
It is a profoundly sobering reminder of the immense responsibility we carry every single time we put the key in the ignition. But, you know, before we sign off, digesting this brief raised a really fascinating kind of lingering question for me.
Oh, what's that?
Well, we've spent this entire deep dive analyzing human agency, human failure, and human adaptation, right?
Yeah.
But as our local highways rapidly fill up with autonomous vehicles, cars that rely entirely on digital cameras, LiDAR arrays, and automated sensors to navigate, how will computer vision handle a sudden blinding blast of sun glare?
Oh, wow. I didn't even think about that.
Right. If an AI system's cameras get washed out by the low winter sun on the Hutchinson River Parkway and it causes a 5-car pileup, who is liable then? Is it the human sitting passively in the passenger seat reading a book? Or is it the software developer sitting in a cubicle in Silicon Valley?
That entirely shifts the concept of comparative negligence, doesn't it?
Completely.
We are definitely going to have to do another deep dive on the legal nightmare of AI drivers. But until next time, make sure you top off that wiper fluid, use those visors, and stay safe out there.